Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The pandemic has changed how we connect between Zoom meetings and virtual classrooms. We're spending more time than ever logged onto devices for school and work. So how can we maintain a healthy screen diet and limit our time on our devices when so much of our life now revolves around virtual gatherings? It's a particular concern to parents, as many children are spending the school day in online classrooms. So how do parents limit their child's screen time when so much more of their lives are being lived on screens? Let's talk about it. Joining Cincinnati Edition to discuss screen time during the pandemic, our screen education president, Michael Mercier. Michael, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
And we also have with us clinical psychologist and Transform Consulting CEO, Dr. Robin Arthur. Dr. Arthur, welcome as well. Do we have Dr. Arthur? Both of our guests are joining us via Zoom. We'll make sure that we connect with Dr. Arthur in case we're having some problems there. But we do have Michael on the line. And Michael, if you wouldn't mind, I hope I say your last name. Is it Mercier?
Mercier.
Mercier. Yeah. Okay, we've got a couple of vowels in there. I will say it correctly moving forward. And you've got a presentation going on this evening, as I understand it, involving Lakota schools about the impact of social media and technology on youth. What are you seeing right now in this weird time? I mean, we know kids love screens anyway, but in addition to their recreational use of screens, they're on them a lot more for school these days. What are you seeing?
Well, I think one of the issues that kids are having in terms of studying from home is social isolation. And they're isolated enough already with spending 7 hours a day on screens for recreational entertainment purposes. But now we have this problem. And the problem there is that they're sort of socially isolated, right? So they spend so much time on screens that it's crowding out the time they spend doing other activities, including socializing face-to-face with friends. And my research has shown that kids are saying they're actually starved for spending more time with friends face-to-face. They're actually, two-thirds are frustrated by the fact that they don't spend enough time with their close friends face-to-face. So now we're in a situation where they're spending more time at home, so they don't even get to see friends at school, right? I mean, they don't get to see people face-to-face at school. So it's even more isolating. So a couple of issues that are emerging are that they're spending more time socializing digitally while they're at home, right? And they're doing some of that during the time they should be studying.
So when kids talk about wanting to be back face-to-face, I mean, I'm sure that even we adults can understand that, missing our friends as well. But when we adults get together with friends, it's for social interaction, for chatting and that sort of thing. I'm wondering if you're noticing whether kids would like to just get together and play on screens together. I mean, are they missing their video game time with their friends, or do they want to get together and go outside and play?
Well, I don't know. I think it's simply just being together. So I don't know that there's necessarily a specific activity they want to do, but it's simply just being together, being in the present, physical presence of other people. So for example, my research has found about a third of kids say they spend more time socializing with their close friends, not just average, people they see at school, but close friends through screens than they do in person. And then, like I said, two-thirds say they wish they could spend more time face-to-face. So for example, I mean, one of my suggestions would be to address that would be for parents to see if they can have a couple of friends over during the school day,
Well, what about, not just addressing the loneliness, but I mean, actually addressing it by bringing someone else into the household to perhaps visit. But what about talking about the feelings that you might experience while, experiencing this unique situation where you're learning from home and then you don't get to go out and play the way that you used to? What type of conversation should families be having with these kids?
Well, I think here's the thing with all the research I've done, right? If you're an average parent talking to your kid, kids don't like to talk about these problems, right? They don't want to admit, okay? And I know this because I have kids, right? They don't want to admit that there's a problem, right? But as a researcher, if I talk to kids through an online survey or through focus groups, kids that I won't be able to have any impact on, I can't limit their screen time, they will admit that they are very frustrated with the amount of screen time that they spend, right? So, but there's a resistance to discussing these issues with parents because this fear, that they're going to take the screens away or severely limit the screen time. So I think one approach that I think is very helpful for a parent to get a kid to open up, right, is to number one, talk about the issue repeatedly over time. So if this is really a concern of yours as a parent, right, I would start to sort of integrate it into the home, you know, sort of value system and the home's consciousness. It's just something that we're concerned about, as we are concerned about eating healthy foods, right? So we talk about this a lot. So just making it a habit and an integral part of the intellectual life of the family would, I think, help a lot to open kids up. And then number two, I think it's very helpful if parents can admit, you know, that they have a problem too. So here's where I'm coming from. In my focus groups, I've found that kids feel blamed, right? Kids will say that they feel like their generation, right, is being unfairly blamed for being addicted to screens. And they'll say, it doesn't make any sense because my parents are as addicted as I am, right?
Yeah, that's true. We can see that.
Yeah. So I think as a parent, and also I want to say I've done research with people of all generations and all ages, right? It's a huge problem with every age group. It really is. So I think the second thing is if parents can admit to the child that they have a problem too, if they really do, you know, I'm assuming that the vast majority of parents, you know, are to some degree compulsively using screens, right? So if they can admit that they have trouble putting it down too, and also say, look, everyone does. It's cross culture and across age groups. The problem is the technology. It's not the person. That's how I look at it now. So I think if parents could admit that they have a problem, that they're not blaming the kid, you know, and take more of a collaborative approach to talking about the problem, right? And don't make it one-sided, you know, like, let's both talk about our issues, right? Or here's an article I just saw. I wanted to show it to you. What do you think about that? You know, I think that could go a long way to getting kids to start to open up generally about the problem, to admit that it is a problem, and then possibly over the long term, take a collaborative approach to, you know, setting rules to address it.
Okay, that's Michael Mercier. He is president of Screen Education. We're also joined by Dr. Robin Arthur, a clinical psychologist and the CEO of Transform Consulting. Dr. Arthur, I'm sorry we had some problems connecting with you earlier, but you're with us now, right?
I hope I am. Can you hear me?
I sure can. Thank you for your patience, and we're glad to have you. And listen, you discussed this before as if people are dealing with an addiction here, right?
That's correct. They absolutely are dealing with an addiction. We know that every time you hit your screen for social media, that you're getting what we call a dopamine hit. Just like for cocaine users, for heroin users, for alcoholism, it's the same part of the brain. And we also know with addictions that the younger you start your addiction, the harder it is to break. So the younger we allow our children to start using social media, the harder it is to break this habit.
And so
I'm very concerned.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, we're talking about all kinds of situations now because, sure, kids are curious about social media, if it's TikTok or Snapchat or that sort of thing. They also enjoy their video games, and so parents might want to monitor how much time they're spending on that. But now you have this situation where kids are using their screens nearly all day simply to learn. What's the danger if you're dealing with an addiction to then have more piled on top of that by mandate?
Right. And I'll say this, the online learning is a little bit different than the social media because the social media is designed by the technology companies to give you intermittent reinforcement to the things that make you happy. So there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes that parents need to be aware of in how their kids are getting addicted besides just when they're doing classroom work online. But I think part of the concern is when parents hear statistics that since 2011, the hospitalizations in teenagers is up 69%, and in preteens is up 189% for mental health issues. And we know it's directly correlated to social media, the anxiousness, the depression, kids who want plastic surgery because of how they look on social media. So it's a huge problem for our children.
Well, if it's a huge problem for our children, I don't expect you to solve that problem during this short segment that we've got today, but it doesn't seem like there's much of an opportunity to rid our culture of social media. So what do you suggest to parents who have questions about, you know, my kids really having some self-esteem issues because of this addiction to social media? How do you counsel that?
Well, one of the things I tell them is it's not just their emotions. We're changing our brains. We're changing the shapes of our eyes. Our attention span has gone from 12 seconds to 8 seconds. We have less attention span than a goldfish now. So, and it's just not the kids, it's the adults too. So again, like Michael said, I'm glad to hear him say that, parents need to realize it's their issue as well. So I say, let's make this a family solution. So no phones at the table, absolutely no phones in the bedroom at night, no matter what. Buy an alarm clock. We still have an alarm clocks if we need them to wake us up. There's radios for music. Those are some of the things kids tell me that they need their phone for. No phones in the bedroom. Set the example for your children of a time limit and how much time you use your phone for social media things. And then get outside, do things as a family. Play board games again, not on the computer. Some old-fashioned things can come back. And I 100% agree with you. Technology is not going to go away. We need healthy boundaries around our technology. So teach mindfulness and meditation. What we don't want is that our kids are using social media as what we're calling a digital pacifier when they're upset. So let's teach them skills of how to deal with their emotions in real time so they don't have to turn to their social media to make them feel better all the time.
We're talking with Dr. Robin Arthur, CEO of Transform Consulting, also a clinical psychologist. We're also joined on Zoom now by Screen Education President Michael Mercier. And Michael, what do kids have to say about their addictions? Do they reference with that type of terminology?
Yeah, it's funny. I first started doing research with kids on this issue in 2016. And typically about 75% in focus groups, right? In focus groups, 75% would typically admit that they feel like they're addicted to their screens, right? And then after 2017, that's when sort of the media coverage of this issue exploded. It dropped down to about 20%. But they'd say, but then you'd ask them about their friends. Well, what percent of your friends are addicted to their screens? And they'd say 80%, right? So when the word addiction became sort of pejorative in the culture, referring to screen use, they would no longer self-identify as addicted or self-label as addicted to their friends. But we can get at that, you know, how addicted they are through other means. So, for example, in some of the national surveys I've done, we'll ask kids, do you wish you had a greater ability to self-limit your screen time, right? Which would suggest compulsive use. And 65% say yes, right? So that's two-thirds. 68% said that they've attempted to reduce their screen time. And 69% have said that they'd be happier if they could spend less time on screen. So those three measures right there are signs that kids are aware that it's causing problems and it's frustrating them and making them unhappy, conscious of. They also, in my research, I've gotten into things like whether they're even conscious. You know, there's this whole argument that's been out there for a few years that, you know, these are digital natives and they're just different, right? They're different. But I've tried to explore whether they really are different. Okay, you're digital natives. Do you still find that the screens are causing problems for you, right? Even though you're a digital native. And so, for example, I think something like 45% of kids in one of my surveys said they feel that their phone use shortens their attention span. So they're conscious even of that, of their attention span being shortened. 41% said that they don't achieve the grades they know that they're capable of achieving because they can't stop using their phone. You know, so, and then, you know, in qualitative discussions with kids, all getting into all the social issues and social anxiety, they're fully conscious. That's what I'm finding. They are fully conscious of all the problems that we tend to recognize that they're having from the screens. They know it and they're frustrated by it.
And we're talking with Michael Mercier, president of Screen Education, as well as Dr. Robin Arthur, a clinical psychologist and CEO of Transform Consulting. Up next, we'll be joined by a professor from the University of Cincinnati, Claremont College, to talk about what may be the benefits of online distance learning during this pandemic. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with our guest via Zoom, Michael Mercier, who is president of Screen Education, and also Dr. Robin Arthur, a clinical psychologist and the CEO of Transform Consulting. And now we are also joined by Dr. Patty Godel, who is from the University of Cincinnati Claremont College, where she is an associate professor of accounting. Dr. Godel, thank you for being with us.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you. And we're talking a little bit about screen time and kids and students these days. But in addition to that, we should assess how beneficial or effective the online distance learning is. And you've been at this actually a long time, well before we all found ourselves in this position, whether by choice or not. And you see plenty of benefits in this remote delivery of education, right?
Certainly. I've been teaching online for about 15 years now, and academically, I think there are a lot of benefits from the technology that we have available to us today. Specifically, I've noticed with my courses, students that attend a traditional face-to-face class or lecture, they have one opportunity to hear the material. They go, they sit, and they either get it or they don't get it. When you transition that material online, the content is available whenever the student wants it, and the student has the ability to review it as many times as they like. So a student that may struggle with the concept can watch it over and over and over instead of it being a one and done.
You have said before, Dr. Godel, that there are two misconceptions about online courses, that they're one, easier, and that two, the work can be submitted at any point during the semester. Those aren't true, right?
They're not true. The content is accessible whenever the student wants to, but there's definite deadlines. They still need to access the material. They still need to learn the material. They still need to pass assessments. And in many cases, the online realm requires more discipline and sometimes more work than a face-to-face class.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I should say, I earned a master's degree through online learning and thought that, yeah, this is actually really hard. It's not easy at all. It's exactly what you would expect from graduate level education, but kind of missed the opportunity for those in-classroom discussions. Do you see any drawbacks at all just from the delivery of the educational experience, perhaps on the social side of things?
Certainly, to whatever mode of education you're looking at, there are pros and cons. With the online education or an online master's program such as you went through, there's a lot of flexibility for working adults. Now in COVID, clearly the social distancing, it's more of a health mandate than personal mandate. But there are some drawbacks there. We try to create communities in these online environments, but it's more difficult than going into a classroom and physically seeing people and sitting with people and collaborating with people, certainly.
I guess on the other hand, though, I mean, you said you've been at this for 15 years now. So when I think back to 2005, we were probably still using like Instant Messenger as our most frequent online communication method. And you'd certainly have some friends that you only knew that way, but it might still seem strange in the so-called real world to have friendships that you don't know these folks. That's completely changed. Like, our whole culture has changed with the way we view online socialization. Have you noticed any impact on the education field as the culture has evolved in the way that it understands and accepts digital lives?
Students are definitely more open to the online relationships than they were before. In the past, you'd have a discussion board and people were reluctant to participate as much, whereas today it's commonplace and students are just as likely to post something in a discussion, hey, I need help with this, can you help me, as they are to look across the aisle and physically ask someone. So I think it has become ingrained in the modern student.
And so, Dr. Godel, we're talking about college students in your case, and that's the level which you teach. But we're also talking in general with our other guests about younger students. Are you able to speak at all on what you might see as a difference in the delivery of educational tools through digital platforms exclusively when it comes to younger students?
I don't think so. I think when you speak from a purely academic perspective, online and face-to-face is just the way in which you're delivering content. And I think in many respects, they're equivalent, particularly now we have video technology where in my classrooms online, you are learning from me. You're watching videos that I have created and lectures just as I would give in a face-to-face classroom. And again, they're more accessible. They can watch them over and over and over. I think the question becomes the social element. They're in the K through 12 academic realm, you have a lot more going on than just education and academics. There are a lot of social things that become important consideration when you talk about transitioning education online that are a little more difficult to get in an online environment.
That's Dr. Patty Godel, Associate Professor of Accounting at the University of Cincinnati Claremont College. We're also still joined now by Michael Mercier, President of Screen Education, and Dr. Robin Arthur, Clinical Psychologist and CEO of Transform Consulting. Michael, I'm wondering, as I talk to Dr. Godel about this, if we have relationships with these screens, is it hard to differentiate? Say when you're learning and you're using a tool that you previously used mostly for recreation and now it's part of either education or profession, does that make it challenging to be productive at all?
In what sense?
Well, I guess what I'm asking, if I use my iPad exclusively right. for, say, social media interaction previously, but now I need it all day for Zoom meetings, is it more difficult to adapt to being on task because I used to just use this device to play?
I don't know that I could necessarily answer that question. I intuitively, I wouldn't think so. I mean, the real risk is just when you're supposed to be studying, right? Compulsively having this compulsive desire to use the recreational content. Right. And if you could use that on another tab on that same screen, or you could use that on a separate laptop or a smartphone. So I don't, you know, personally necessarily think that just because I usually access social media from this screen, that I would have trouble adapting to using other content for the screen.
Well, Dr. Arthur, I know that you've characterized the use of a heavy use anyway of like social media platforms as an addiction. And so I'm wondering if you are someone who acknowledges that you have an addiction and now you're using that same device that enables you to get that high, but you need it for something that you have to do. Is there any type of problem there? Am I just reading too much into this?
No, I think there's absolutely a problem there. You know, one of the things you can do is you can take as many apps off of your phone or other device as possible, so you're not getting that intermittent reinforcement from all those notifications of what's happening. So the less distraction you can create for yourself, the more you can attend to what you're supposed to be studying. And we know that these kids, especially adults who take their phones to bed at night and they're up all night long, we know the lack of sleep will lower their performance in school, and it will also make them much more susceptible to mental health issues. Lack of sleep is directly correlated to mental health issues. So, I mean, in an ideal world, kids wouldn't start using social media until they were at least 16 years old. And we as adults have to really take charge for them. They're still children. We would never hand them a 12-pack of beer and say, go drink as much as you want. And I think I want parents to consider that that's what social media is like for them, and it affects the same part of their brain. So they should educate themselves as parents as much as they can on how to do this in a healthy way, so you're not being divisive with your child, but you're helping them understand what's happening to their brain as well.
Well, Dr. Arthur, what do you recommend as it relates to different ages of children? Are there certain ages where different types of devices and different types of access levels to internet opportunities should be determined and considered?
Sure. I think what I recommend is very different than what's happening because there's a lot of social pressure for parents. And I can certainly appreciate that, having raised four children myself. But if you listen to the people who created all of this social media, they do not allow their children on social media. So the longer you can wait, you can give your child a phone for safety so they can call home and things like that without giving them social media. And I think that's important for parents to remember. I certainly think the tween years, 11 to 15, are very difficult years. And when we add social media into that, that's where we're starting to see a lot of the issues. Kids in the preteens, their suicide rates are up 151%. And we know a large portion of that is because of social media. So I think parents just need to understand that we cannot be passive about this. I mean, in my ideal world, we would start passing some laws about how young children can be exposed to social media and how it's affecting their brain and what it's going to do long term, and which is very different than learning online.
That's Dr. Robin Arthur, CEO of Transform Consulting, also a clinical psychologist. We've also been joined by Screen Education President Michael Mercier, as well as University of Cincinnati Claremont College Associate Professor of Accounting, Dr. Patty Godel. They've all joined us via Zoom today. I really appreciate the conversation you all gave us today. Thank you so much for being on Cincinnati Edition. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And it is the last day of the WVXU Cincinnati Public Radio Fund Drive. You can still give at 513-419-7155. And we'd also appreciate it if you gave that a try at WVXU.org. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of this program are online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.